The Jericho Network on Westwood One.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pod of thunder and rock and roll. And a quick thanks to the great sponsors who are making today's show possible. Indeed.com, O'Reilly Auto Parts, and DDP Yoga. And today is Friday, so you know what that means. It's time for the Duff McKagan Joke of the Week.
Hey, Chris Jericho. It's Duff McKagan calling you. I hope everything's well for you and all the listeners there. I got to tell you, I had to go to the doctor for my depression. Caused by my obsession with crossword puzzles. He told me not to get too down. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Classic Duff, clever, good one. If you haven't heard Duff's new single, speaking of good one, Chip Away, you got to check it out. He released it a couple days ago. It's on his new solo album, Tenderness, which comes out on May 30th. Go check that out. Duff is a great songwriter in his own right, and obviously a Rock and Roll Hall of Famer with Guns N' Roses. All right, today it's the return of the classic album clash, Iron Maiden, Number of the Beast versus Power Slave, and I've assembled an expert panel to debate the merits of each album and its respective songs. I got Metal Blade Records founder Brian Slagle, huge Maiden fan, just like me, returning for this one. Lizzie Borden, another Talk is Jericho alumni, another big Maiden fan, is with us, and so is Solo Cup Jeff. Yeah, he's with us. I think he actually stays awake this time. I can't remember. We're going through the album track by track and sharing our own Maiden experiences from the first time seeing the band live to the first Maiden album we each bought. And of course, the debate of song by song, which album do we think is better? You also hear a little history and trivia about the new wave of British heavy metal, the scene that spawned Iron Maiden, Def Leppard, Saxon in the late 70s. So let's get a rock on. Okay, here we go. Classic album clash. Iron Maiden starts now on Talk is Jericho. All right, so we're here at the amazing Cosmo Hotel. By the way, I was supposed to plug that. I forgot my other two podcasts, but I'll plug it here. The Cosmopolitan right here on the Strip in Las Vegas. It's the best hotel that you could ever stay at, right?
Yes. Okay.
Yes. So we're here to do another classic album clash, and we are doing today Iron Maiden, Power Slave, and Number of the Beast. And we have Lizzie Borden, who
hello.
Is an expert in heavy metal. You've released many albums. You know the whole story. Solo Cup Jeff is here. He's awake.
Well, hello there.
Yeah, and you have to say more than seven words. You have to actually participate.
I'm working for eight.
Last time he passed out during the podcast, but we're just starting to drink. And then the grandfather. The great grandfather, the oldest fuck guy. No, Brian Slagle.
Rode in on my wheelchair just for you.
Slagle is here, and I think probably out of the two, the four of us, you and I are like the Maiden fanatics.
Yes, I would say so. Forget the four of us, like out of the millions of people around the world, maybe. Yeah,
right. Probably the top 1%, maybe. What was your first exposure to Maiden, and why are they so big to you?
So I was a tape trader back in the day. And a friend of mine sent me an AC/DC tape from Sweden. And at the very end of it, he said, hey, there's this new band called Iron Maiden that put out this single called The Soundhouse Tapes. I think you might like it. So I listened to the AC/DC concert, which was great, with Brian Johnson. Oh, no, actually, I'm sorry. That was Bon Scott.
Yeah.
Even better.
Soundhouse Tapes.
So anyway, I listened to Soundhouse Tapes. I'm like, oh, my God, what is this? And that was the first time I heard about the new wave of British heavy metal. Became obsessed with it, became obsessed with Iron Maiden, and then since then they've gone on to become and still are my favorite band of all time.
And how many times, what's the first time you saw them?
First time I saw them was, I had to fly to Houston actually, because in 1981 they were not going to play in LA, so they're opening for Judas Priest. So I flew to Houston and saw them, and that's still the only time I've ever talked to Steve Harris. I actually interviewed him for my fanzine then, which was amazing, and had him sign my copy of the Soundhouse Tapes.
That's cool.
So that's the first time I've ever seen them.
Talk to Steve. I know like all those guys, but I'm still intimidated by Steve Harris.
Same here. I've seen him in a million times. I have some funny stories about that, which I think we talked about, but they're too long to say here. But same thing. I've seen him. I want to go talk to him, but it's like, it's Steve Harris. I can't get to that.
He's kind of a shy guy too, so he's not going to go out of his way. Like Nico is easy to talk to, yeah. Or Bruce, but
Steve's a little bit quiet.
All those guys are like, I had a great time with Dave Murray when they played New York about a year or so ago, because I know the management. Obviously, we all know the management really well. Dave and I just started talking about blues and guitar players. Like, you coming to Chicago? I said, yeah, oh, let's go watch some blues afterwards. I'm like, it never happened. But
he's smiling the whole time.
Yeah, it was still nice for the invite.
Yeah. Liz, what was the first time you ever heard of this band, Iron Maiden?
I think I told you this last night. I was in a band early on in... Dio and Iommi were in this studio, in the same studio that we were in rehearsing.
Really?
It's Harlequin Studios in the San Fernando Valley.
What band was that?
It was a band with Joe Holmes, actually.
Okay.
And Joey Scott and me and a couple other guys. And we went through so many names, it was ridiculous.
Yeah.
But we were rehearsing. They were in the main room working on the live album that they did. And somebody from their camps came in, heard us rehearsing, and said, you guys sound like Iron Maiden. And I just said, who's Iron Maiden? I never heard of them. And this was, and Bruce hadn't joined the band yet, I think.
So what live album would that have been?
It would have been the
Live Evil.
The Live Evil one, yeah.
Oh, I thought you were talking about Maiden. Gotcha. Oh, so Live Evil.
Sabbath were there doing Live Evil, which was 81, I think. 82. Was it right? 82?
Which, by the way, you know what Live Evil is backwards?
Live Evil.
Which is just really cool. And then I went out and checked, you know, bought I think they only had two records out at that time, and bought those records, went, wow, I don't think we sound anything like Iron Maiden, but I like them, you know, the dual guitar, and that's what we had.
And that's Lizzie Borden, one of the staples of your band is the dual guitar, which is a very Maiden-esque thing.
Right, yeah, it was, but it was, for me, it was, you know, Judas Priest, I was so familiar with Priest at the time, that Maiden came out of nowhere for me. And then I went to Anaheim Stadium, and this is when they were on tour with the Scorpions, and I think it was for Number of the Beast.
Yep.
And they sold me. And they had Bruce now, and it was like, oh my God, this is a new thing here. With the Scorpions and, you know, Iron Maiden, and there were 70s bands like Loverboy or a few other bands on the bill, and it was just like obvious.
But that's how it was back in those days. You'd go to, like, I think one time Maiden toured with like 38 Special.
Yeah.
Like they opened for them on a run. Like you would just, rock bands were rock bands, right?
It was a mixture of different things all the time, and there was no rhyme or reason. And when Scorpions and Maiden played back to back, it kind of just said, these are the new kids in town. This is the new style. Get on board and get out of the way, all the other bands.
Yeah.
And I was like, I was on that train. I was like, let's go.
Let's do it. How about you, Solo Cup, Jeff?
Well, the first one would be Peace of Mind. But I saw the picture disc, you know, when they had the picture albums back then.
Yeah.
I was like,
I remember that. It was the cover was the straight jacket, but the back of it was them sitting at the dinner table about to eat the brain, each of them to take a piece of mind.
Yep. And back then it was really awesome when you could find one of those like cool picture albums.
Yeah.
You could play it and it was an actual album. Really,
what a lost thing, the picture disc.
We still make them every once in a while, but there's just nobody that makes them. It takes forever because, you know, it's hard to get vinyl made anyway these days. Mm. There's a huge backlog, and now there's like, I think there's one plant that makes picture discs. So every once in a while you can sneak one in, but the wait time is forever. But yeah, those things are awesome.
I remember the first time for me was I was a big Beatles fan when I was a kid. And when I say that, like, I knew everything about the Beatles. Like, I just got obsessed with them in about 1980, so I was 10. At the time, as weird as it seems, if you liked the Beatles, it wasn't cool because the Beatles weren't cool like in the early 80s. You know, neither was like the Black Sabbath or like the bands that were kind of on their downswing. So when I went from elementary school to junior high school, I noticed very quickly that all the chicks were wearing rock shirts, like metal shirts. Like, remember those 3/4 inch, like they used to call them baseball jerseys, baseball tees? And it was Priest and Ozzy and Dio. And the one girl that I liked, her name was Marcy Wood, had a Number of the Beast one on. This is like, you know, in my mind's eye, she was like the hottest chick
that
in school.
Girl's got to be cool.
Yeah. It was super tight jeans and a Maiden baseball jersey with Number of the Beast on it. And I remember looking at the album cover going like, this is scary shit, you know? And I remember too, I went to a Ukrainian summer camp with Chad and Todd, my cousins. And someone played Number of the Beast. And
Ukrainian? Not in the Ukraine.
No, but like Ukrainian camp. Like you learn how to, like my family's Ukrainian, so you would like Ukrainian dancing and like painting Easter eggs.
Canada's fancy.
Very, very popular in Canada.
Canada's fancy.
Especially if you come from Winnipeg and Saskatchewan, a lot of Ukrainians there. But somebody was playing Number of the Beast. And you hear that intro, and it scared the shit out of me because we were going through a big phase at the time of like talking about like the Armageddon and the Antichrist and all this stuff. And it was kind of really freaky to hear this, you know, woe to you, O earth and sea, for the devil. And I remember like being like scared, like this is freaking scary. So it kind of like, they're like a little bit of a horror movie type element for me at first. And then the first time I saw them was the Power Slave tour with Twisted Sister opening up for them.
That's
why for me, Power Slave is always been the probably the album closest to my heart, because that was the first tour that I saw, and it was the first Maiden album that I bought. And I took the bus downtown to Records on Wheels and bought the Power Slave cassette. And I didn't have my Walkman, batteries ran out. So I remember the whole bus ride, like reading the lyrics and looking at the pictures. What's this going to sound like? Like, I can't wait to hear this. And also I remember it had the running time of the album, 55 minutes and 43 seconds or whatever. I'd never seen that before.
It's because it was long for back then. That's why they did it. Because like the albums then were 35, 40 minutes.
But they were using that as a badge of honor. Like it's 55 minutes of metal, right?
Yep.
You know, so to me, that was why I was so into Power Slave. And that's what we're talking about today, which is Power Slave versus Number of the Beast. And I think they're Peace of Mind is great too, but there's a couple songs in that album that kind of get a little bit, not shaky, but they're not up to snuff, where I find Number and Power Slave are pretty much eight great songs and eight great songs.
Yeah, they're the two albums with the most classic Maiden songs on them.
Right.
Sure.
Right, exactly. So what was your first, you said you bought the first two.
But when Number of the Beast, that was a game changer because, you know, Bruce's vocals were, you know.
Right.
There was another singer in my life that I liked.
You know? Yeah.
Because I didn't like all these singers. I liked, you know, a select few. But then Bruce came in and was like, okay.
And even was called the Air Raid Siren.
Yeah.
He's listed as that on the back of the album, the Air Raid Siren, Bruce Dickinson. Like, I remember the second I had the podcast, I said, can I still call you Air Raid Siren? He said it was a Rod Smallwood came up with it and just said, well, we're going to call you the Air Raid Siren. He's like, Air Raid Siren? What the f*** does that mean?
And I think the way he had, I mean, I hear Ian Gillan, you know, in his voice. Mm-hmm. And that's who my first vocal coach, even though I never met him. But
really? Ian was your first?
Ian was the first one. I heard Child in Time and I said, I want to figure out how to do that.
Wow, yeah.
And so I worked on that high scream for so long. But how I adapted was, you're in a small rehearsal with two guitars on a 10 and everybody blasting. So you have to sing above the band.
That's true, yeah.
And I'm sure that's what Bruce had to do too. And that's how he developed his vocal style too.
Yeah, he said that Ian Gillan and Dio and then The Crazy World of Arthur Brown. Yes. Arthur Brown were his three vocal.
That's the classic influence. English thing for sure.
And you can see that with Bruce's outfits that he wears this day, a random jacket or a hat or a mask. And that's very Arthur Brown.
It's interesting too about Maiden is that, you know, because I was still working at the record store when Number of the Beast came out. And it was a really ongoing thing about who was better, Bruce Dickinson or Paul Di'Anno. It was really split 50-50 in the metal community back
then.
Really?
Interesting.
Half of the people are like, oh, I don't like it. We like Di'Anno. Because, I mean, those first two records were so amazing. People felt so in love with them and they were so attached to them that, you know, a different singer with a whole different, I mean, he's a completely different sounding singer than Di'Anno was. And a lot of people, it was definitely 50-50. Look, I loved it. I mean, Number of the Beast is still my favorite album of all time. So I loved it. But I understood it. It was really interesting because, you know, you could get, I don't know, you could find this that many people now that would argue that. But back then, it was a pretty intense debate with people.
Well, and the thing I always laugh at was that people say, oh, yeah, Paul Di'Anno is like more of like a punk singer. Like, he was not a punk singer.
No.
His range was awesome. He had an awesome range. Listen, like, Remember Tomorrow?
Yeah, amazing.
High-ass singing.
Well, and the funny thing, too, is the funny story. So they eventually, on that tour, after I saw them in Houston, came to LA and they opened for UFO at Long Beach. And I interviewed Paul Di'Anno for the fanzine then. And he told us during the interview in the afternoon before the show that this is going to be my last Maiden show, that I'm quitting the band. I'm going to leave. And we're like, Florida, what are you doing? And he said he wanted to get out because he wanted to do something more melodic. It's like, really?
Paul said that?
That's what Paul said.
Well, and that's also saving face because we all know that they had fired him at that point in time.
I think there was definitely some
it's the famous story that they went to the Reading Festival to see Samson. Steve and Rod went there with the specific, you know, intention of scouting their new singer. And then when they went to talk to Bruce about it.
Well, they had known him before because they played some shows
They went
together.
To watch the, you know,
they wanted to see him play in front of a big stage. Could he play in front of the big stage?
Kind of a front man, is he? And apparently he came off stage and the first thing, they gave him a leather jacket because he used to wear a white leather jacket. It's like, you have to wear a black leather jacket. And they said, you know, would you like to audition? He said, well, I'm not auditioning because if I decide I want to do this, I'm going to get the gig. But here's what we're going to do. And he talks about this in his book. And I've noticed this, and you watch Maiden, is at first, Steve was the front man. He was running the stage. But when Bruce came in, Bruce was like, no, the bass player stands in the back. And Steve's like, no, this is my band. The singer stands in the back. And they're fighting for center stage space, to where they finally had to move the monitors together or apart one of the ways, so that each guy had his own little area to stand in. I can't remember exactly which one.
Well, and that's why in the early days, Adrian and Dave were so far apart. Like, they were all the way on the sides of the stage just to stay out of the way from the two guys in the middle fighting over the stage presence. It's funny.
And that's another thing, like, as a bass player in high school, and now, you know, you obviously, and then Bruce is a hero of mine, but I was more of a bassist in school than a singer. And Steve Harris was the guy, because you could hear the bass more than the guitars even. And I'm sure it drove guitar players crazy at first when they first heard that. Like, what's the mix on this? So bass friendly. But obviously that's, you know, the Maiden style.
Signature style, yeah. I mean, when I was a kid, I didn't know what bass was. You never heard one of the 70s records. Like, what's bass?
Drake,
I had no idea what that was.
If you're an AC/DC fan, it's like, well, that's the thing in the back that you hear, like, going bump,
well, except
bump,
for
bump, bump,
except bump, for Livewire. Dun, 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 dun.
And Soul Stripper.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. What was the first Maiden show that you saw?
Well, like I said, it was the Houston one in 81. So I guess I'm the only one that I saw them with Deano of our little group here.
How was it with Deano?
Oh, it was amazing.
How was he as a front man?
Phenomenal. I mean, it was a different story. Like, Bruce is the, you know, run around the stage and constant movement and stuff. And Deano had a presence about him. Like, he was up there and he was hardcore, you know. He looked amazing. And they were phenomenal. The funny thing was it was at this Coliseum or something. And I had seats like seventh or eighth row. And this is back when they had seats on the floors. So my friend and I were there. We were standing up going crazy. And the security kept going, sit down. You got to sit down. I'm like, I can't sit down and watch this stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm like, I'm having a religious experience here. Let me go crazy. But no, he was amazing. I always loved him as a front man. Completely different than Bruce, but he still had a presence of command up there that was awesome. But he didn't move a lot, so he was very Halford-esque, in all honesty. I mean, he looked like he had the whole
great
get up,
point,
kind of,
yeah,
like Halford kind of did, because Halford doesn't really run around on stage either, so it was very much a Halford sort of vibe. And then Steve was kind of, you know, doing his thing as the kind of main, but I thought he was great. I thought Deano was phenomenal.
What was your first Maiden concert, Jeff?
Same one as you,
Powerslave. Because, yep, I remember they came the year before to Winnipeg, Peace of Mind tour. Mm-hmm. But I didn't go because I didn't really know them at that point in time.
Correct,
know?
And I was a little young because that was the first year I got to go to concerts on my own, was in 84.
Do you remember who opened for them in 83, Peace of Mind? Coney Hatch.
Oh, wow. Coney Hatch probably, right?
Yeah,
Coney Hatch opened for everybody.
I saw them on the Peace of Mind, and it was Saxon.
Oh, right on.
Power and the Glory.
Oh, that's cool.
And it was awesome.
I think
Coney Hatch might have been the, I think it was a three-band bill.
Oh,
was
maybe.
In the States, even?
I'm trying to remember. I saw Coney Hatch a lot in the States. They opened for tons of bands.
So the one you saw, Lizzie, was the, I think it was called the British Metal Onslaught Tour. And it was Maiden and Saxon, I think Fastway.
That's the
right
one.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
You're right about that, because, yeah, I saw that in San Bernardino, where I almost got crushed to death. And then I saw it. And
you almost get crushed.
It was
to either death.
The. Because I was the only time I've ever been in the front of a show, and I got all the way to the front, because I'm like not that kind of guy, but I was like, yeah, freaking Iron Maiden, I got to do it. And by halfway through Saxon, I'm like, I'm going to die. I got to get out. So I got out and just watched the rest of the show from the back, which was way more comfortable.
That's a great thing, though, and it's something that I use for Fozzy in that. Playing bigger venues, even if you don't know if you can fill them, you have, you know, it's like Field of Dreams. If you build it, they will come. And that tour was Rod's brainchild, where they had been opening. I think the Number of the Beast, they were opening for Priest.
Yep. Was it Priest and Number of the Beast? They opened for, I'm trying to remember.
Somebody. I think that might have been the 38
special. Scorpions, right? Or, yeah, they were doing like little bits and pieces of stuff.
Point being is that Rod said, we're doing an arena tour. And they said, well, you're not big enough to do an arena tour. He said, we're doing it. And somehow he was able to convince the promoters to book the arena tour with the British Metal Onslaught with Saxon. And they did great.
And they did two there. Southern California shows. They did San Bernardino one, which is about, you know, 2 hours outside of L.A. And they also played at Long Beach Arena, too, which
and that
amazing.
Put them on the map.
Yep, totally. Big time. Because they were not, they didn't have a radio hit. They didn't have an MTV hit. They didn't have anything at
nothing.
That time. So a band to play arenas, people were like, you're crazy. But
and some really shitty videos. Maiden have never had a good video.
Yeah, you might be right about that.
Wasted Years, maybe?
I was going to say something off of like one of those, like the Clairvoyant or something, kind of had an interesting video.
Well, Clairvoyant was,
it.
I think, from Download. So anytime you could see him play in front of a giant
yeah.
crowd like that.
Yeah.
Because Can I Play With Madness was stupid. yep. with the guy from Monty Python in it. They fall down a hole or some yeah. shit, or like
lame attempt at British humor.
Run to the Hills, where it's like just old
the Indians.
Cowboys yeah. and Indians. You know,
and that got a lot of
Flight of Icarus
too.
Though. Yeah. Flight of Icarus was the one that MTV played constantly, and that one wasn't too
and
bad.
And that Shadowy got bigger. Probably the most radio play for them.
And they haven't played that song in years.
I know Bruce
so
hates
weird.
It.
I know. Oh, I know. Hates it. I know.
They had remember the Number of the Beast video that has the devil in it. Mm-hmm. The rumor is that that's Nico McBrain.
Yeah, maybe.
I think it is.
Possibly.
Let's say it is. Okay, so before we start doing the song by song debate, always a popular segment of the show, the Classic Album Clash, let me say thanks to the sponsors who are making it possible for us to do this in the first place, and that includes Indeed.com. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Go check it out now. Talk is Jericho is also sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts. When it gets cold out there, your vehicle needs some extra attention. That's the truth. O'Reilly Auto Parts is everything you need to keep your vehicle toasty, warm, and running. From choosing the right antifreeze for your engine to replacing your windshield wiper blades, O'Reilly will help you get your car or truck in fighting shape for the cold weather ahead. We've still got a few months of it left. O'Reilly Auto Parts, better prices every day. All right, so let's go to a little bit of tail of the tape here, talking about the two albums in question, Number of the Beast and Power Slave. So Number of the Beast came out on, March 22nd, 1982 is when Number of the Beast was released, produced by Martin Birch, and it is 39 minutes and 11 seconds long. So it's very compact, and whereas Power Slave is September 3rd, 1984. Also Martin Birch, 51 minutes and 12 seconds is the running time of that. Now let's, right off the bat, let's talk about the album covers. In Number of the Beast is obviously the famous where the devil is playing an Eddie, puppeteering an Eddie puppet,
mm-hmm.
and then standing over him, puppeting the devil, is Eddie.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very iconic cover.
Yep.
What do you think about it?
In all honesty, it's my favorite album of all time, but I can't say that I'm a massive fan of the cover. It's okay. It's a good cover. I think when it came out, it was really striking, but as time has gone on, it doesn't quite stand the test of time as much, but it's an iconic cover. So
yeah.
What can you really say about it?
I always like the fact that when we used to have these arguments when I was in high school.
I liked Eddie with hair. So,
whereas who would win in a fight, Eddie or the Hellion? From Judas Priest. And I remember these guys like, the Hellion's got like missiles on it and guns. I'm like, Eddie controls the devil.
Yeah.
He wins.
Yeah, exactly.
He
wins. Hands down.
Plus but, that's probably on the most t-shirts.
Right. For the Number of the Beast album cover for sure. Out of all the t-shirts that you would see, it is the iconic cover. But I will say this, the cover of Power Slave is very epic. And that is it. Besides, well, Cut Somewhere in Time is my favorite album cover because because it's got all the clues and details and shit in it. But as an image, I think Power Slave is the one. Of course, yes. It's the Egyptian pyramid where Eddie is carved in stone.
I love that cover.
The god. And just, I love like the lightning and the blue and all that sort of stuff.
It almost looks like a movie poster.
Exactly.
Killers is the greatest album cover of all time for me, not just for Iron Maiden, but for any band ever. Yeah,
for a heavy metal band.
Yeah. But this cover is my second favorite Iron Maiden album cover.
The colors of it.
It just looked so professional, too, back then. It was like, it looked like, oh, my God, this is something just
And it also
amazing.
Has little things in there.
Derek Riggs.
If you look down on the corner, it's got a Kilroy. Remember Kilroy, the cartoon character?
Yep.
It says Kilroy was here. And then on the other side, it says WOTTA. What a load of shit.
Yeah, really? I didn't even know that.
It's in there too.
He's got some trivia.
I got some trivia. We did our meet and greet in El Paso, Phoenix. And we do a VIP thing. We do a little concert for the VIPs, and then we do the signing and all that stuff. And the guy came down the line and gave me a present, which was a framed Eddie drawing by Derek Riggs.
Oh, yeah, I've got a bunch
signed.
Of those.
To Chris from Derek Riggs.
Nice.
And I was like, dude, like this is, thank you, man. Like
that's
what
awesome.
A great, And now I don't have any idea where it is. I hope it's on the bus somewhere.
Oh, geez. Let me know, because I know Derek, so I've got a bunch of those.
Of course,
things.
You
got
to trump me. Every
yeah.
time.
Sorry.
Derek's actually done a self-portrait
of me. I'll trump you even further, because we talk about the album cover and the whole, like, you know, Egyptian theme, which was the theme of the concert. So 10 of the greatest days of my entire life I've spent in 1984 in London. I saw Dio with Queensrÿche opening twice at Hammersmith, and then two of the four shows that Maiden did at Hammersmith as well. What's interesting was they both had literally almost the same stage setup. Dio had an Egyptian stage setup because he was doing
Egypt, the chains are on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then literally 7 days later, Iron Maiden had it. So I remember talking to Ronnie one time, and I go, you know, I saw you guys in the same week, basically, and you had basically the same stage setup. Do you have any idea that was happening? He's like, no, we had no idea. But then he went on a diatribe about how much he hated Hammersmith because everything's all stairs and the elevators. And I go, it's one of the greatest places ever. You're disparaging for 10 minutes. Freaking me out.
Was he smoking a joint at the time?
He was not.
Dio smoked a lot of pot.
Yeah. He might have right before then, but at that period of time, he was not.
Did you see the Number of the Beast tour, anybody here?
Yeah, absolutely.
What was the stage show like on that? That exists because I think the Power Slave tour was the first,
that
like,
first big one,
theme
yeah.
Stage show.
It was pretty standard. I mean, if you look at the Hammersmith video that's out there, the live video, it's
for Pyramids in the back.
Yeah, it's fairly similar to that. A little bit of a bigger scale because Hammersmith is small. Yeah, it wasn't anything spectacular, but it was still good.
They were one of like 10 bands on the bill. So.
Okay, so you didn't get the full stage show.
I don't remember them having any.
Yeah, the full stage show was nice, but it wasn't anything I don't really remember exactly everything was in there. It's pretty similar to the videos that you see.
Now, let me also point this out, that this is the first record that has the same lineup on it from the last record.
I know, right?
Right? So it's the first time they had the chemistry of that classic lineup.
Well, let me ask a question. Sorry to take sure. over from your role there.
Jeez.
So,
calm down, dude.
Hey, you know, we're talking Iron Maiden here. So the difference for me, the big difference for me between Number of the Beast and Power Slave, and why Number of the Beast is my favorite album of all time over Power Slave, is the drumming. And for me, Clive Burr is one of the greatest metal drummers of all time. And I mean, look, Nico is phenomenal, and you can't take anything away from him. And he's obviously been with the band forever and still playing great. But that's the difference. So I'll ask each one of you, who is your favorite drummer in Maiden, Clive Burr or Nico McBrain?
Well, and it's funny too. There's this real penchant for Americans to want to call him Nico McBrain. It's Nico. Nico McBrain. But for some reason, everyone says Nico. It's one of those weird things that you United States people
Celtic,
do.
Celtic.
Americans, right? Celtic Frost. It's interesting because I, once again, came into the fold as a Nico guy. But I think the best drumming ever on a Maiden record is Clive Burr on Number of the Beast. And I'll give you one little tidbit before we move to Lizzie, is that when I had Lars on the show, I said to him, because Lars never uses his toms really anymore. He doesn't do a lot of fills. He uses his snare drum for fills. And I said, why is that? And he said, one answer, said Clive Burr. He goes, Clive Burr uses his snare drum as a fill so many times. And I can listen, I can hear in my head, Hallowed Be Thy Name, right when it goes last part. It's just, it's not like, it's just the snare drum. And you realize that Clive Burr was a motherfucker. Great, great player.
So amazing.
What do you think of this?
Well, I think the records that he was on, those songs, that the drumming was perfect for that. And then when they kind of shifted to more of an epic,
great point,
melodic kind of thing, Nico.
You're going to do it.
I almost did it.
Something.
I wonder if Nico ever thinks that, you know? That's a good
point. He was perfect from then on for what they did. And I don't know. Yeah, because they were kind of, you know, writing 4-minute rock songs.
That's a great point.
Rock metal songs. And then they went to this, you know, picturesque.
The more progressive
but
stuff.
But Nico's
yeah.
more of a prog drummer. I'm not going to say Clive couldn't do it, but it's hard for me to think of Clive playing even like, you know, the Red and the Black 13 minutes and all the different changes and parts. I'm sure Clive could do it, but he was much more of a, almost more of a Phil Rudd type pounder.
Yeah. He reminds me a lot of Dave Lombardo, where he's playing, like Dave plays a little bit different. Like yeah. he's not like you couldn't put a click track to him because he doesn't play to a click track, and neither did Clive Burr. Like he's playing kind of off. I mean, just a tiny second off, which makes it brilliant, which was also what Dave does.
Human, yeah.
And makes it unique. Whereas Nico is definitely, I mean, he's in that groove sort of thing. And I think Lizzie does make a great point with the proggy sort of stuff, that Nico's probably a better player for that
fit
sort of stuff.
That.
I don't know. I mean, Jeff, you came in with him as the drummer too, so.
Right. I came in late, but I mean, seeing the videos from Number of the Beast and stuff and the different because they still had some video where he was on,
right,
in the video.
Yeah,
because Iron Maiden's like Aces High and all that, there wasn't really so much live footage, and this as I remember. But so yeah, I remember seeing him visually, but of course seeing him live for the first time was obviously Nico.
Clive was the guy too, like even in the pictures, he just looked like a rocker. Like he looked like guy, like he would wear no shirt and spandex pants, like holding like a bottle of Jack in one hand and a cigarette in the other.
And
like,
one of the nicest guys ever.
Really? Yeah.
Such a nice guy. But he, you know, he had demons. That's really why they kicked him out. He couldn't deal with the alcohol. I mean, those guys like to drink, but he was like,
it's
so
one of those
up.
Things with Maiden, and much like AC/DC, if you weren't pulling your weight, you might have got a warning or two, but they had no problems cutting your ass loose and moving on to the next guy. That's just the way it was, you know?
Yeah, sad. And I mean, I know they felt bad about Clive too, because they loved him and he came up with them. But at, at a certain point, like if you can't play at a certain level every night, then, you know,
especially as the drummer, man. As you know, drummers got to be.
They drive the whole thing.
Yeah. All right. So here we go into the track by track punch out, starting off with Aces High, well, Invaders versus Aces High.
Well, I mean, look, one thing I'll say is people go about Invader saying it's the worst beginning song ever. I hear that all the time.
Seriously?
Absolutely. And I think the problem with that is you've got literally the next rest of the record is almost the 7 or 8 greatest songs ever written by a heavy metal band or any band, in my opinion. So the first track isn't up to there, but it's still a great track. I mean, look, it's not going to stand the test. I mean, Aces High clearly is a far better track. I don't think anybody's going to argue that. But I had to stand up because I really do like Invaders.
I think Invaders is a great song. But here's
people crap on that all the time. It drives me nuts.
But here's what I love about it. So Invaders, Peace of Mind, they get a new drummer. They open up where he goes there with this really killer little drum fill, right? Yeah. They get a new singer. He's called the Air Raid Siren. And the first song is Invaders. And that song is a f***er to sing that. I mean... I'm not going to say you're going to have trouble, but that would be even high for your range, Lizzie. And you got a higher range than I do. That chorus is crazy. Well,
even the better part is on that song is his phrasing, because he's able to answer. His answers were, you know, really wicked and, you know, giving that kind of those inflections where he's, you know, selling it.
Right.
He'd set it up and then he'd sell it and set it up and sell it. And Aces High is so melodic that he's just flowing with the music. So those inflections are not there. So
that's a good point. And also, too, you're dealing with a guy who was singing songs about whatever Samson was singing about, you know, like Earth Mother and She's a Nice Girl, whatever their songs were. And he's coming and singing this song about Viking attacks and the mighty Norsemen and raping and robbing and killing. You know, I'm sure a lot of times, like, I feel a lot of respect for Geddy Lee. As a singer who has to sing these freaking lyrics that Neil Peart wrote, I'm sure sometimes he's like, what the f*** are you talking about, man? And I think before Bruce started writing, he probably got a lot of those ones from Steve, too. It's like, what is this? What am I supposed to do with this?
Well, it's got to be hard. I think it's got to be hard for a vocalist. I guess, you know, it's funny because you talk to vocalists a lot of times, and some of them think it's hard to sing lyrics that they don't write. But others go like, like Elton John, for example. Like, I'm fine with that, and I can phrase it out.
Yeah, yeah.
It works.
You have to sell them.
Yeah, totally. But that's a difficult thing when you have to sell somebody else's words.
Right.
And it's a tricky thing to do, and not a lot of the time that happens. So
we had to do that on this record. I usually write all the lyrics, but on this record, a producer wrote a lot of lyrics. And they're all like, I can't, he's great at it. But okay, so he wrote the lyric, but I'm the one who has to sell it. I'm the one who has to introduce them to the world and sing it. So you have to kind of internalize it.
Yeah, most people have no clue that Elton John didn't write all that stuff.
Great point. Yeah, great point. So yeah. I'm going to say... for all these reasons that we're talking about, both great songs, but Aces High, one of the top 10 best Maiden songs for me. Just a classic, great opener for the live show with the taped intro with the Winston Churchill speech. So
I got fingers crossed they're going to play that on this next run of shows.
They probably will. You know what they're going to do? They're doing their style.
The legacy
But they got to throw in, like, just give me one, like, give me a Flight of Icarus, or give me a Back in the Village, or give me a Still Life.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. They'll never do it, but...
Well, they might do one. They usually pull out one out of the mothballs.
Maybe.
They better. Liz, what do you think between the two?
You know, I don't know. I Aces High is so embedded in the whole culture of that time, but Invaders is so unique and interesting that I if I had to listen to both of them right now, because I've heard Aces High a zillion times, I would...
So you're taking Invaders, okay.
I would probably pop on
Invaders. Oh, I like it. Cool. Wow. No, I like it. I'd gone out on a limb.
Yeah,
I like that. I like that.
Right. Jeff?
I'm definitely Aces High.
Okay.
that just the starting, when you put that back then, the needle right on the vinyl there, and it was just
it comes out playing, and that is one of the most I say underrated, but that guitar part at the beginning, that harmony part, people never think about that when they think of great Maiden harmonies. That opening harmony is crazy.
That song is definitely my favorite Maiden opening song of an album.
I agree. I like Moonchild was good, but it's not as good as Ace is High. But those are the two that I really dug. Agreed. And also, a little bit, there's a Raven song called Faster Than the Speed of Light.
Oh, yeah.
That has a part that goes, and Steve nicked that for Ace is High.
Yeah, well, Metallica's got an Omen riff in their new album, so everybody's...
Which one?
In Atlas Smog, the dun 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 dun. It's a Holy Martyr by Omen. If you listen to it, it's almost the exact same thing.
Wow, interesting. All right, so the next one is Children of the Damned versus 2 Minutes to Midnight.
This is a really tough one for me, but...
We got the room service guy is going to come. We're going to ask him a question. This is live, people. Sometimes room service people come. So let's see what's going on here. Hello.
Yeah, how are you? In. We're talking about Iron Maiden.
Are you
Iron
familiar
Maiden?
With the band Iron Maiden? Oh, no, yeah, we could. You want to do some karaoke with us? Are you good at karaoke?
I thought
you
had a karaoke party.
Yeah. It's a karaoke party.
Only Iron Maiden karaoke.
Yes. Okay. Is someone you like your name put on the table? It's okay. Just leave it right there. It's fine.
Yeah,
thank you.
Okay, let me put a headset on.
Just sign for it, Jeff. Yeah. Do you like rock and roll music?
And your favorite Iron Maiden song is which one? Ace is High? Yeah. Ace is High, right? Okay. Favorite Iron Maiden song? Ace is High. She said Ace is High.
Well, we're in Vegas, so.
Okay, so as she's getting everything going,
Children of the Damned. I mean, it's a tough one for me because obviously both of them are such iconic. I mean, you know, 2 Minutes to Midnight is one of those iconic songs, but Children of the Damned is in my top probably five, definitely my top five Iron Maiden songs of all time. So I got to go with Children of the Damned.
All right, Lizzie,
I got to go with Children of the Damned too, just because of the hauntedness of it. You know,
it's a great
and the chorus,
the lyrics, the melody.
It's all about haunted. It's very haunted.
Yeah,
you know, when you're talking about once again, that's another Maiden song written about a movie.
Yeah,
and I think the movie's called Children of the Damned.
Oh yeah,
that's actually the movie, right? Yeah, they remade that a few years ago,
and that was a really crazy haunted weirdo movie.
Yes,
This song is just, you know, epic, and it's, you know, Bruce is a god on that song.
Builds so well, sings it very well. That's one of those ones when they busted that out on the Book of Souls tour, everybody was super excited about.
Oh yeah, I always loved that song.
Jeff?
I'm going to have to go with 2 Minutes to Midnight again.
He's wearing a Power Slave shirt.
Yeah, he is. Well, see, he's got a Power Slave shirt, and I got the Power Slave Eddie tattooed on my arm, so it's pretty obvious which ones we like better. But so reasons?
Well, again, because that was the album that I was like first purchased, first I had to cut grass, ride my bike, go down there, buy it, put it on, and get home. Like, wait till you get home, put the needle on the record, and just the whole, it was just, that
it was the
that
one.
Album was just iconic for what it was.
I'm going to go with 2 Minutes to Midnight. Great riff. It's Adrian's, you know, masterpiece, and he's written a lot of them. I love, love, love the solo in that song, and the breakdown of it with just the bass. And once again, a terrible video that I'm not sure exactly what the hell's going on. There's some chicks in the shower, and there's some weird Egyptian eyes going on, and there's like some kind of a guy reading a book or whatever. But I also love the title, 2 Minutes to Midnight. What does that mean? And then find out it's the nuclear clock. And at that point in time in 1984, the nuclear, you know, clock was at 2 Minutes to Midnight, which means we're almost at nuclear war. Haunting in a different way.
Yeah.
You know? Well, thank you. Bye bye.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Okay, thank you. Very good.
Very nice Iron Maiden fan.
She's walking like a dead man. She's like, that's awful. Have you been drinking all night? She's thinking. thank you.
You're doing karaoke
Lizzie
with her
much better
tonight.
Than I am. So yeah, 2 Minutes to Midnight is the one I'm going to go with. And to this day, when they don't play it, it bothers me.
Yeah, you know. I mean, it's one of those ones though where they play it so often that you kind of like,
they do, they dropped it last tour, but you know it's going to be back in
it's
there.
It's like Sabbath with Metallica. I mean, I love that song, but stop it.
I was listening to a podcast today or something where people said that some guy was like, Sabbath is the worst Metallica song ever.
No, that's
because
not
it
true.
Sticks out like a sore thumb. I
think people are just tired of it.
Okay, so next up is The Prisoner versus the instrumental Lost for Words, Big Aura. But before we get to which song is better between the two, Let me tell you what there is absolutely no debate over, and that's the benefit of getting on Diamond Dallas Page's DDP yoga program. It doesn't get any easier than this to stick a good workout and nutrition plan. It doesn't get any easier than this to stick to a good workout and a nutrition plan. And you can even work out with Dallas and get some tips in person if you're going to be in New York for WrestleMania weekend on April 5th. DDP is hosting another live DDP yoga workshop on April 5th during WrestleMania weekend. Sign up now at ddpyoga.com. And if you aren't going to be in New York April 5th, go download the DDP Yoga Now app and take advantage of the 7-day free trial. DDPY is the program you've been looking for, and it'll get you on the path to healthier living and keep you there. Taking care of yourself is the best thing you can do for yourself and your family. So take advantage of the 7-day free trial of the DDP Yoga Now app and give Dallas's life-changing program a solid 1-week try for free. Own your life for free. Get started at ddpyoga.com/Jericho. Once again, it's all free. I love the DDP Yoga Now app. I can't say enough about it. You know, I know you'll love it too once you try it. And like I said, it changed my whole life, enabled me to continue wrestling at a high level, continue to play on stage, made my life so much easier and better. And I know you'll love it too if you're having problems with your back, your health. You just got to try it. Download it today and own your life. Sign up for your free 7-day access at ddpyoga.com/Jericho and pick up Dallas's book to help you get started. It's called Positively Unstoppable, The Art of Owning It. It's filled with lessons from Dallas's own life. You can get it wherever books are sold, and you still have time to sign up for the DDPY retreat, which is happening June 23rd to the 29th at the 5-star El Dorado Resort in the Riviera Maya. Eat great food, meet great people, squeeze in some live DDPY workouts with Dallas. Reserve your spot today at ddpretreat.com. That's ddpretreat.com. It's a great time. I was there a few years ago. Own your life, get in the best physical and mental shape you've ever been in. Go do it now. ddpyoga.com/Jericho. Go check it out.
So, okay, after that is Prisoner versus Loss for Words, Big Aura.
Well, that's the one where it's no contest.
No contest, yeah.
It's Loss for Words. No, I'm just kidding.
Interesting, though, Maiden had an instrumental on their first two records.
Yep.
And then this was the return of the instrumental and also the last instrumental they've ever done.
Yeah, I wonder if that's a Bruce thing, because Bruce wants to sing. Because I think, you know, there was some prevailing theory that Invaders was going to be an instrumental track.
Really?
Because it's a little hard for him to sing. I mean, I think that's why people don't gravitate toward it. It's a difficult song to sing over if you look at
that's what Lizzie said.
Exactly. So, and he does a great job on it. So I think his stab is like, look, whatever you give me, I can figure it out. As opposed to maybe Deanna, I was like,
Yeah. I do like Lost for Words. I think it's a great instrumental. But like you said, it's a filler track.
Yeah.
It's a cool idea. And when I was a kid in high school, I used to try and write lyrics and melodies to it just as an exercise, you know, to see like, oh my God, what would I do for a melody in this? Okay, that's cool. Now let me see, what would I do? Give me another version of it, you know, but No contest. And Prisoner.
Does Mr. Power Slave Jeff over here agree with that?
I agree.
Okay, good. All right, there
just
you go.
The intro alone, you
a
know,
Prisoner,
from
yeah.
the TV show or whatever.
Another classic Maiden written about so look at this. Bruce comes in the band. The first three songs, one is about Viking attack. Two is about the movie Children of the Damned. Three is about the TV show The Prisoner. Yes. He's probably thinking, what the hell are these guys on? What's the trip for these dudes?
They were influenced by what was happening in their lives, you know? And I was the same thing. You know, we're watching splatter flicks all the time, so that was what I wrote about, you know.
Love you to pieces.
Yeah.
In the best is this really hot chick sitting kind of on a bed, and she's looking all cool, and in the mirror behind her you can see Lizzie Borden standing there with an axe.
Yeah.
I always love that, but it's very subtle, like, oh, like it's a hot chick, love you beast. Oh no, wait, there he is.
And every day someone says, you know what, I just discovered
never
that.
Know it right.
I had that album forever and I just discovered
yeah that's pretty cool.
Well, it was tricky because back then we didn't have like big album cover budgets or album budgets or anything, so that I love the way that image came out. It came out really good, even though we probably just didn't spend much on it. We just got some decent photographer.
The guy who shot it did portraits for like graduate students and stuff.
If you want to push one of Charlie's buttons, just mention to him the cover for Fistful of Metal. I'm still trying to figure out what the hell's going on in that.
I think everybody's trying to figure that out.
The fist is coming through the guy's. Well, first of all, it took me a while to figure out, is the guy punching him from behind? It's coming out of his mouth, but the fist, the thumb's on the wrong side.
Yeah.
So imagine my thumb being over here. And that's what you're seeing. So the guy's obviously some kind of a mutant with a thumb where his pinky should be.
All those early 80s when we had zero money to do stuff or all, there's a lot of bad.
Okay, yes. And you're the one. You're the one who signed off on Night on Brocken.
We had no other choice. It's like the band sent it in. They're like, well, I guess it's drink. Funny thing about that, though, we changed it. And then all of the fans now want the original one. So we reissued again with the original cover. Are you guys crazy?
You guys got to own that
shit. We burned the original one. We've actually burned it.
For all you guys listening, if you haven't seen, Google Face Warning Night on Brocken. And you'll see, is it a witch getting,
I don't know, what
it has, stake or something? And it looks
just
like it's
like worst album covers of all time. It's generally the top 30 or something.
It looks like it's been drawn by, like, not even by an 8-year-old. An 8-year-old would do better.
Yeah.
It looks like someone who's got like severe mental disabilities.
By a
monkey. Give 1,000 monkeys 1,000 years and they'll draw the cover.
Pretty much. Rocking.
All right. Then we go to 22 Acacia Avenue versus Flash of the Blade.
You know, this is a tough one for me, actually, because I love Flash of the Blade. Of course, the song title itself is amazing.
Another great song title.
I know. That's a really... Because Acacia... I'm going to have to go with Acacia Avenue just because it's another iconic song, but that's... I don't know. Maybe... I don't know where I want to go. Why don't you guys answer? What do you think about this? I was debating this all night long.
I love that song just because of the 22, because it's the atmosphere of where the lyrics are taking you.
It's about a prostitute.
Yeah, and that's one of those things where it's like, okay, well, where are we going with this? And so you're following along intently instead of just listening to it. You're actually listening to the lyrics and where this is going and what he's, you know, where are you taking us?
Yeah. I believe, and imagining this, but I believe on the lyric sheet, it might have even had the continuing story of Charlotte the Harlot.
Yeah, that's what it was.
It was, right? But I remember it actually said that.
Yeah.
It's about her, yeah.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really cool as well. I got to tell you, though, man, I mean, Flash the Blade, here's an interesting thing about Flash the Blade, solely written by Bruce Dickinson, which I don't think he's done since until Book of Souls Records, like with Eternity Should Fail and then the Empire of the Sky or whatever it was. But
Empire of the Cloud.
Empire of the Cloud, sorry. I knew if I said it wrong, you'd pay attention. Yeah, man, 22 Acacia Avenue, if you're feeling down, depressed, down, around. I got to go 22 Acacia Avenue, but I always love the chorus of Flash the Blade, and I still don't know what the lyric is on that. You die as you lived in a flash of the blade. Which I think it's like in a corner standing by no one or something like that, which doesn't make any sense at all.
But you can pull it up on Google. I mean, I think I lean toward Flash of the Blade on this one, even though I love Acacia Avenue. But Flash of the Blade is one of those like Iron Maiden songs that they never played live.
Good call.
That is kind of one of those, you know, people think is a secondary song because they never played it live. But when that record came out, I always loved that song. I was super bummed that they ever played it. I always asked Smallwood, do you think they ever, they'll never play that song. I'm like, really?
It's funny though, because you think like, you know, that had a guitar intro that everyone could play too. I remember I was shitty at guitar, but I go,
it's a great song. It's like Sun and Steel is another one that's kind of a forgotten classic too.
It's a great song, and that's a fun one to sing, but this is what bugs me. You'll die as you lived in a flash of the blade in a corner forgotten by no one.
Well, it's kind of meant, I think you're just, the whole idea of it is that, you know, some worthless soul is being killed by the flash of a blade.
But the melody of that doesn't fit those lyrics. In a corner forgotten by no one. It's weird.
You got to fit the lyrics in somehow.
It's a weird lyric. Jeff?
I'm going the opposite again. 22?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of the right answer.
Jeff's like a wise man. He's like, you're all waiting for bated breath to see what he's going to say.
I just like it because the verses as well. I mean, they haven't done anything like that, and they kind of abandoned that whole kind of thing, and that's kind of almost a Queen
thing. What thing you're talking about?
You know, the...
Just
the guitar and vocal,
right?
Thing.
Right.
They haven't really
done
too much of that I know of.
As we're talking here, and they're getting ready to do like the Legacy of the Beast tour, that'd be so cool if they busted out either one of these songs.
Oh my god, it'd be
if they just did one of
fans
these.
I wonder, the fans would freak out, but then when some fans go, I want to hear, you know, they won't play.
But at this point,
the Damned
in time,
or something.
No, it's like if they do one of them, that gives you a reason to want to go again.
Yeah, they'll never do it though. I talked to Rod all the time about this sort of stuff, and because I'm always the fan in there, kind of needling him.
But they busted out Seven Son of a Seven Son.
But that's a pretty iconic song from that record. That's a great record.
So 22 Acacia Avenue.
I agree. I mean,
Paul Smallwood now.
All right, yeah, we'll call him now. By the way, the reason I wasn't paying attention 2 minutes ago because I was trying to figure out which thing we're doing this for. So are we doing Number of the Beast with Total Eclipse on it or without Total Eclipse
well,
on it?
Well, Total Eclipse is not on the album.
Well, it's on the secondary version. Well, it wasn't on the original one.
That's what we're dealing with here. All right. And we'll get to that when we get to the song.
All right, question. Fine.
There's some controversy. But
I'm out of here.
The whole thing is that each album has to have the same amount of songs. That's my rule.
Oh, okay, got it. All right, fair enough.
Then we go to, wow, it's interesting. Oh, Number of the Beast versus the Duelists.
Oh, well.
Do we even need to?
Do we know? I don't even, other than talking about how amazing Number of the Beast is. We don't
well,
really
the funny thing with
anything.
The Duelists is, it's, I think, 6 minutes and 18 seconds, and I think there's a minute and 30 seconds of singing on it. It's very quick to sing. It's that whole 4 minute middle section is what the song is based all about. And it's some great noodling, some great musicianship. But you know, it's a great tune, but it's
an awesome song. But yeah, I mean, it's when you're doing verses, and it's like, that'd be Chris Jericho versus the 5-year-old kid in the WWE ring.
Yeah. I always loved, too, was I lived alone. My mind was blank.
Yeah.
I needed time to, Get the
memories.
Yeah, but no, my warp mind.
Yeah.
But everyone thought it was a woman when I was growing up.
By the way, the thing about Number of the Beast 2 is, in my opinion, the greatest scream of all time is Bruce's scream in that song.
That's
my God.
With Roger amazing. Daltrey and...
yes. Yep. You know, Won't Get Fooled Again.
Well, that's exactly where he got it from. But when I first heard that scream, I'm like, how could anyone even do that?
And the thing that's cool about it is apparently Martin Birch made Bruce do that like... you know, 18 times.
Yeah.
And it was the last one. Like, he's like, I can't do it anymore. And he's like, well, you don't have to. That's the one.
Wow. Perfect. And didn't he do all the vocals on that record in like 10 hours or something?
It wasn't that quick, but it was very quick.
It was pretty quick. Maybe 2 days or something like that.
I know too. Like, it's interesting because there's certain singers. You mentioned Roger Daltrey. I saw The Who a couple years ago. He still sings great, but obviously he's a 70-year-old guy, but he still nails that scream. I went and saw Loverboy. Mike Reno still nails the scream in Turn Me Loose.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. And Bruce still does the scream in Number of the Beast. And it's great because
it's pretty close. He can't do it quite.
He's
there,
got
but it's
one
close.
Scream that he uses in certain places, and it's a great one, but that's what he puts in there. He still gets close to it.
Yeah, hey, as close as you can get.
I lived alone. I left alone. My mind was blank. I always thought it was I lived alone.
Yeah.
I needed time to think the memories from my mind. What days, I believe. Yeah. Just what I saw in my old dreams were the reflections of my woman staring back at me is what I thought it was.
But that's what I always thought it was.
My warped mind warped staring mind. Back
yeah.
at me.
The woman is yeah. I mean,
that's like Benny the Jets. I always thought it was electric boobs.
Electric boobs?
Yeah.
It's boots, right?
Boots, yeah.
How about You Knothead by Judas Priest?
Say what?
You Knothead.
Oh.
You Knothead, You Knothead, You Knothead. I thought that was it. And then the other one was, I thought it was Big Old Jed Had a Light On. Big Old Jed Had a Light On. Come and take me too far away.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff like that.
Jeff, do we even have to ask? What were you going
to
say?
No, I was just going to say figuring out lyrics we used to have to figure out lyrics to do cover songs off of the album.
Wow, right.
And just listen to it and then write it down. I remember we used to do nothing but UFO songs. And Phil's voice is so monotone that you can't distinguish some of the words. And to this day, I wrote those words. I'm like, this can't be right.
Yeah.
But I have no choice. There was no internet at the time.
Yeah, you couldn't just Google the lyrics.
And in the 70s, Harley Eagles bands put lyrics in. I remember I was a huge, and still am a huge Blue Oyster Cult fan. And they didn't have any lyrics, and their lyrics are crazy. And it was just driving me crazy. So they had a thing where you could actually send $5 in, and they would send you back the lyrics.
Oh, wow.
Like typewritten out. So
wow,
I actually
no
have
kidding.
Those for the first three records.
I did that for Blue Oyster Cult, too.
Yeah, yeah.
I still have it somewhere. It's
yeah,
all
I have it in
up.
My vinyl, yep.
It's funny for the Judas vinyl that came out. Like Sin and Bones, it was a double gatefold big thing. Do Honest to War, lyrics and pictures. And then I get, you know, the new phone book is here. You get it in the mail. I open it up and it's like just the paper sleeve. And I'm like, that's, you know what I mean? Like there's no lyrics, no pictures. I'm like, we just got AC/DC'd. Because AC/DC never had any lyrics or pictures. They would just be like the paper sleeve. You'd pull it out. You know, Jeff, do I have to even say?
Well, The Duelist gets unfortunate because they're the last song on the first album. First side of the album.
Good call.
And Number of the Beast is the first track on the second.
Great
That's
point.
That's a really great point. That is a great point.
See, the wise old Jeff comes in with a good point.
So there was a reason why he's here. Good.
That's it. Yeah, because Number of the Beast is 4-4, and Power Slave, one of the songs we're going to talk about, is 5-3.
Yeah, interesting.
Good point. So you're not going to put the rocker on last.
Right. Right.
You got to save it for the first.
And back well, then, what's the, what, there was
so
sides.
You could go. Well, we could also, but it's the debate still would be over. You go back to Acacia Avenue versus the Duelist, the ending song.
Yeah.
Then it's going to be Acacia
Avenue. It's still Acacia Avenue. Okay, so here we go to the next one, and it's Run to the Hills versus Back in the Village. Yeah, kind of another massacre there. Yeah.
I mean, I actually like Back in the Village.
I love Back in the Village.
But I mean, Run to the Hills is like one of their iconic songs. But they also don't play live anymore.
Run to the Hills?
They haven't played live. Oh, I didn't play well, live for a while.
Wait 3 months, you'll get it for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
You'll get it for this one.
They haven't played for a while.
I think I had this thing I did with the Avenged Sevenfold guys. But is there such a thing as a perfect album? And the criteria is every song has to be A minus or better. If you were going to debate Power Slave as being a perfect album, the one song that someone might not go for is Back in the Village. They might say that's a B+
And Number
song.
Of the Beast is probably going to be the one we're going to talk about next, Gangland.
Exactly. Yeah. But I love Back in the Village, but once again, it's got very prisoner lyrics. It's another song about the prisoner. If you look at those lyrics, that's all very weird and background.
That was a huge show for Steve Harris, so it makes sense.
But this one was Smith and Dickinson.
Oh, really? Interesting. Yeah. Oh, yeah, you're right. You're right. Yeah. You're right.
The Smith Dickinson. I guess connection. Maybe.
They also all grew up in England at the same time, so it was a big show for all of them, I'm sure.
Well, yeah, and Number of the Beast, or sorry, Run of the Hills, Steve Harris, you know, obviously great composition, still one of the most singable songs, and probably Maine's probably biggest radio hit.
Probably the biggest, which is funny because they don't like, they haven't played Run of the Hills or Flight of Icarus, arguably their two biggest radio hits in the
U.S. Right.
For a long period of time. So here's a band that's still selling out arenas on a nightly basis, not playing their biggest songs. You imagine if Enter Sandman wasn't played by Metallica? Yeah, it'd be exactly. A riot.
It's been such an Iron Maiden thing to do, right?
It's like, exactly.
Not even
I love it.
Bother.
I love it.
Doing
but
it
but for me, it was like that was the beginning of metal in Hollywood, and there's this English band putting out this heavy song with a very singable,
interesting
song, a chorus.
So let's talk about that. So what was it like in Hollywood in '82 or whatever when Maiden kind of gets released and everybody's on the strip, everyone's hanging out, but now
Everyone dressed completely different, and all of a sudden black leather jackets came in, and when that came in, everyone was looking for the bands that would fit that criteria.
Well, the interesting thing though about the strip was before, like I saw Iron Maiden. I saw Motley Crue and Rat, you know, for $1 on a Wednesday at the Troubadour for the first time I went to
$1?
See there. Yeah, $1.
Wow.
And they were both heavy. Like Rat was like Judas Priest. They had Jakey Lee was in the band. They all were. They looked exactly like Judas Priest. They had black leather outfits in. Jakey Lee played the. He was basically playing the KK Downing, and then the other guy was doing the Flying V, and the scene was super heavy. And then Motley kind of took that when they did Too Fast for Love, they kind of took that little more commercial route, and then a lot of bands went that way. But there's a whole underground of metal stuff too, where you know bands like obviously Metallica and Slayer both came out of
right.
So it was two varying factions, but I think even the you know quote unquote hair metal bands were of course hugely influenced by Iron Maiden. I mean,
me and all my friends were into all the English bands, Priest, Maiden, Saxon, you know, UFO. So I don't know. I wasn't even listening to American bands at the time, except for Kiss.
Right.
And I saw Judas Priest at the Starwood. And they were still dressing. They were caught in between their image change. They were still dressing kind of like Jimi Hendrix or something.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So it'd be kind of in the 70s.
Priest. Well, yeah, you see early Priest on the video.
The pimp hat.
Yep.
And then, but when the leather jackets came in, I mean, I remember it was before Lizzie Borden, but we were all like excited. And then when we got to see the video for Run to the Hills, I was like thrilled because they were like, you know, opening this door, and I wanted to step through that door.
It's interesting too. It reminds me of like when Rush, known for their lengthy epic songs, but arguably their biggest is Closer to the Heart, which is a 3-minute radio song.
Yep.
And it's the same for Run of the Hills. I think it might be 4 minutes long or whatever it is. Made known for these epics, but that's the one that people go to the most.
Catchy chorus.
Yeah, Kiss Chorus, great breakdown in the middle. Dun, 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 sing-along part. That is a
another good scream, too.
And it's also one of those ones that, like, as a singer in a band and as a visionary for a band, it's a song I wish I would have written because it's the ultimate live song. Like, you play that song. They should, like, Detroit Rock City should open every Kiss show.
Yeah.
And Run of the Hills should close every Maiden show.
Yeah. Yep.
You know what I mean? Jeff, do we even have to ask?
Nope.
You got it right.
He's confirming.
He's still awake, so we got that going. There you go. I think this is when I have enough vodka today. gang. Okay, there's the controversy. Gangland versus Power Slave. I was reading about it today in my 30 seconds of research I did for this podcast, how there was a big debate over whether it would be Gangland or Total Eclipse. One was going to be the B-side for Run of the Hills. The other was going to make the record. And Steve himself says it should have been Total Eclipse. We f***ed up.
Yeah, everybody agrees it should have been Total Eclipse. But they eventually did. It's on the record now, obviously. But
at the time it came out. And
it was weird, too, because I got the record when it first came out, and I got the single with Total Eclipse on the back. I'm like, oh, my God, this song is amazing. How did this song not end up on the record?
Amazing singing on that song, too.
Yeah, I think the theory was back then that Gangland was kind of faster, and maybe it was still kind of the faster punk rock sort of band, had that influence to it.
You know, that's
so that's
point,
why it
man.
Ended up on the record, whereas this Total Eclipse, a better song, was more kind of mid-paced, and they kind of needed a faster song in that part on the record.
It's interesting, dude, because you're right about that. Because if it was Total Eclipse, it starts slow.
Yep.
And they had just had on the record, what are we listening to? Okay, Run of the Hills is a fast one. But yeah, I wonder if the flow of the record would have been disrupted a bit.
In talking to people about why they did that, that was what they thought about back then, was the flow would have been disrupted. But in all honesty, it probably should have been Total Eclipse. They're great freaking songs. Probably the best B-side ever.
But
that I can
think it
of.
Didn't make it on the record. So what do you think about Gangland?
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, Gangland's all right. I mean, it's a decent song, but
The one that might not make the A-minus criteria.
Probably.
For a perfect
album.
Look,
still to me, that's the greatest metal album ever recorded, written, everything. Even with that song on it. But yeah, that's not an A-plus.
And that's
song.
The thing I love about these classic album clashes. We're not saying that both albums are A-1000. And both albums are great. But when you start breaking down some of my songs, some of them are like, wow, it's not like it's still a great record. But like we said, like Gangland against Power Slave, it doesn't even come close. But it is also the only song ever written by Adrian Smith and Clive Burr.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Interesting. Maybe that's why it's on the record.
Yeah, that's right.
Give Clive a little publishing
love.
Yeah.
Give him a little love in there. Power Slave, I mean, top five Maiden songs for me.
Yep.
On a given day, it might be my favorite.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, it's the epitome of what Maiden is to me, from riff to solo to lyrics to catchy chorus. And once again, written only by Bruce Dickinson.
Yeah, it's a brilliantly written song. So now, as a wrestler, how do you feel about Bruce wearing the wrestler's mask during that song?
Well,
it's
a lucha mask. It's a Mexican wrestling mask.
Oh, yeah.
And once again, why?
Well, you wrestled in Mexico. So.
I did, but like, I love A Crazy World of Arthur Brown Bruce. Why is he wearing a Mexican wrestling mask to sing a song about Egypt?
Yeah.
and also, the name Power Slave. Like, when I was a kid, I would go to the record store and look at the back of the record and decide which songs I liked just by their song titles. You know what I mean? Like, I know, like, Master of Disguise, for example, when Lizzie put that out, I liked that song even before I heard it, because I love the title Master of Disguise. I love the title, you know, like Menace to Society. Like, what a great, like, cool title. So Power Slave to me, not just as an album title, but as a song title, it's powerful, man. It's really fucking heavy.
It's an amazing title, and it's an interesting, but have you ever figured out what a power slave exactly is?
Well, he's a slave to the power of death.
Well, yeah.
He's addicted to death, so yeah, he's a power slave.
Yeah.
Right? It's like if you're addicted to sex, you're a sex slave.
Yeah, all right.
I guess. And who knows what Bruce was into? He's kind of an interesting cat. Jeff, what do you think?
Power Slave is definitely one of the songs that wasn't a strong one on me at that album when it came out. But it grew on me as I more matured into my music, as obviously I liked the hits at the time and such, and I was young. And then now, if I go back, that song is definitely one that I turn up in my car or anything. It really, if I ever hear it live, it's just, yeah.
And once again, when they did that on the Book of Souls tour, I flipped out. Because Maiden does the same set for the whole 2 years. And when I saw that one, Power Slave's in the set. Mm-hmm. What a great choice. With the ultimate Iron Maiden ending. It never ends. The ending is a minute long. It goes forever, ever. It just keeps continuing on and on and on and on.
Awesome song.
Great song. And once again, I'm sure it probably bothered Steve a little bit that, you know, the whole concept of the record was based around Bruce's song. But I'm sure Steve was fully on and behind it, because he calls pretty much all the shots.
Well, yeah, clearly he calls all the shots.
Yeah. Okay, final. And this might be the hardest one for me. Hallowed Be Thy Name versus Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner.
This is, by the way, the easiest one for me.
Wow.
Because How Would Be Thy Name is the greatest song ever written by any human in the entire history of mankind.
Wow.
So that's why it's easy for me. Now, that being said, clearly, Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner is one of the greatest songs ever written as well. So it's really, it is, I get it why it would be tough, because they're two of the most iconic Iron Maiden songs. And probably, you know, I don't know where Rhyme would rank in my top, I mean, I don't know if it'd be top five, but it'd be top six or seven. And when it came out, that was the longest song I think anybody ever done. And it's like, it's an interesting, I mean, it's an amazing song, especially live. But How Would Be Thy Name, hands down for me, even though Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner is a phenomenal song.
Jeff?
Caught me early on this one.
You are familiar. You've heard both
of
the songs.
We were waiting to fall asleep.
Yes. Yes. You weren't expecting me to be still here. Right. Conscious. Yeah, that's a tough one for me, because back and forth, you know, one's an epic long.
Well, they're both long. It's right. Just that one's double the length of the other one. Yeah.
Yep. I think I'll go with
How Do That End.
Yeah. There's my mumble. I do believe it's going to edge it out.
You should have asked like this just as a joke. Well, you know, kind of like maybe like How Be Thy Name or something. Or, I don't know. I'm going to go next. I'll let Lizzie go last. Like you said, man, How Be Thy Name. If you're not going to play Run to the Hills last in the Maiden set, you should play How Be Thy Name. It is possibly my favorite song on Number of the Beast.
Correct.
Going through. Yeah, it actually is my favorite song on Number of the Beast. And I used to play it when I was in my high school band, Scimitar. And it was a fun song to play on bass, although I'm sure I was playing it completely wrong, but we thought we were playing it right, and that's all that matters. But dude, for me, one of the reasons why Iron Maiden is one of my top three favorite bands, and they all might as well be number one, which is Beatles, Maiden, and Metallica. There's no, they're all at 100%. I love the fact that I could listen to a Maiden album and learn something. And once again, the song title's Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner. What does that mean? What the f*** is this? On that bus ride going home, looking at these lyrics, and they continue and continue and continue, and there's this story about this albatross and the wedding guest and water, water everywhere, and all the boards did shrink, water, water everywhere, and not a drop to drink. Like, oh my gosh, I went home and got the encyclopedia. Remember the encyclopedias, kids? Before there was Google, you had books that would tell you shit.
That gigantic book.
Looking up Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner so I could read the poem by Samuel Taylor Coleridge and read the whole thing. Dude, I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about it. The solo section in that, the scream in it, the riffs, the changes, to me that's Steve Harris's masterpiece as a song writing style. So Hallowed Be Thy Name is 100% and Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner is 100.2.
yeah,
you know, I'm gonna go with Rhyme, but it, if they play that on this tour, I'll flip out.
They might. They've been playing a lot
for the Summer on Time tour.
Yeah
Summer on Time tour.
You never know they might. I play really long one.
I'll tell a quick story too. That if you've ever seen, there's a Maiden documentary about the Power Slave years, and Nico's talking about they were doing some gig somewhere in Eastern Bloc countries. It was super hot, and he's wearing his spandex bodysuit, and there was a swimming pool behind the venue, and during the middle breakdown, like Nico's like he knows he's got like 3 minutes to do nothing as he goes boom loon 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 loon. So he runs out from his kit and jumps to the swimming pool and he's like, and I'm underwater and all I hear is like boom 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 boom. And they're like, Nico, get out. And I said, I know my gig, I got 30 seconds to get back. And he said he sat right back down and was like, he's soaking wet. Yeah,
probably feel good.
What do you think, Liz?
Well, I mean, Hallowed Be Thy Name, just mainly because of Bruce. I mean, that's his star song.
Good call. Wow. You know,
when just that up scream that he does at the beginning when it starts to build, you know, you got to take a big breath for that thing.
Oh, yeah.
It's just like, oh.
Running low.
Yeah,
running low. And it starts low. And as you know, this is a singer, and people don't know this if they're not singers. It's hard to sing low and clean
and
running low
and stay in tune.
Even that whole part, I'm waiting.
Yeah.
Like that's hard. Like it is to stay in tune live.
Yeah.
It's easy to belt out the screams if you have the range.
Yeah.
It's like playing electric guitar in accordance to playing acoustic guitar.
Yeah. That's a good point.
Yeah, it's interesting. You talk to a lot of singers like Jeff Tate, for example. If you ever talk to him, his voice is super low.
Yes.
Like when he's like, "Hey, I'm Jeff Tate." And then all what? It's like, how do you, but that's where he's comfortable singing.
He's got that type of voice.
And he was really hard for him to sing low. Like the original singer from Fate's Warning, John Arch. Same thing. He could sing in this high range, but any sort of mid-low range was almost impossible for him to do. And he had a pretty normal speaking voice. So it's interesting about that.
I had the same, even like recording, like singing low on records, it's very hard. Because like you said, you hear it, it's your naked voice. And for Bruce to do that live and nail it every night.
I think that's his tour de force. That's his one where he shines.
That's his vocal masterpiece.
I think so. I mean, out of all the songs, he's the music is as exciting as his voice. But in that song, he's the star, I think.
See, I argue that every bit of that song is the star, because like every piece of that is so iconic. I mean, the bridge towards the end and the two leads are two of the best leads I've ever seen in my entire life, which drives me nuts that friggin' Yannick Gears plays Adrian Smith's lead every night. I mean, Adrian's standing right there.
Oh, it drives me nuts that he
why is he doing it?
And it drives me nuts that he plays the opener for 2 Minutes to Midnight, and it's wrong.
I know. Well, yeah. But it's funny that I saw them in Chicago on the Somewhere in Time tour? Somewhere Back in Time tour. But anyway, so we're playing that song, and Yannick had a problem with his guitar. So I was with a whole bunch of friends of mine. So they all know. I turn around and close my ears when he does that solo because I can't stand it.
It's not good.
So they were all looking. We're all looking, and like Adrian's looking over, going like, "Okay, is he going to get his guitar back in time?"
And there's some on this one.
So it came where he didn't get the guitar back. So Adrian had to play the solo. So I was freaking out. All my friends were laughing. He totally bungled it because he probably hadn't played it in a million years.
Someone's got to do it. And Adrian, he's such a quiet, humble, great guy. And he told me, because I said, why do you let this happen?
Exactly.
Why are you letting the guy that replaced you still play your CDs? Because he goes, he was playing the parts when I left for the 10 years. I'm not going to come back in. He said he wanted to do it, and that's fine with me. He doesn't care. But meanwhile, when he plays, like, he's the best musician on stage.
Oh God, yes.
When that Book of Souls tour, I said to him after, you were the best musician on that.
Well, if you look at the history of Iron Maiden, every record that Adrian plays on pretty much is a good record, and the records he's not playing on are not very good records. He's the glue.
There's certain chemistry to a hockey team.
Exactly.
There was a guy
any sports team.
There was a guy called Claude Lemieux.
Yep.
Played for years. Won. I think he won like 8 Stanley Cups.
He didn't win 8. I think he won maybe 6.
Okay, 6.
A lot.
Sorry, Mr. Science.
Sorry.
Mr. Hockey. Point being, he was a third line guy.
Yep.
He didn't do a lot, didn't score a lot of goals. But when he was on your team, you won fucking championships.
Yep.
Adrian Smith's the same. The moment Adrian left that band, not even Bruce, the moment Adrian left, the quality went down.
Oh, big time. And I had dinner with him, actually, strangely enough, right after he left, because a friend of mine was doing radio stuff for his thing. He said, hey, you call me up. You want to have dinner with Adrian
Hotel?
Smith? Yeah, for whatever the first thing he did. He said, do you want to have a dinner with Adrian Smith? I'm like, yeah, I'm there in 2 seconds. So, and a super nice guy. First time I really talked to him, and super nice guy. And eventually, after a few adult beverages and a nice long dinner, I said, so, why leave? And he said, I just felt that we had done all we could do at that point.
Yeah.
And the newer stuff that they're working on, I just didn't feel was the quality that I wanted to be, and he left. And sure enough, that next record was...
But it was awful. Also classic Maiden, because it wasn't that cut and dry. If you talk to him now, it was almost like, yeah, well, I should leave. Well, yeah, well, maybe you should leave. Okay, well, maybe I should leave. Okay, you're gone.
Yeah,
What?
Yeah.
He said that because he said he went to Donington in 92 and watched them play and was like crying. Like, what the f*** did I do?
Wow. Yeah, well, I think I think they all did that. I mean, Bruce left as well, and... eventually, I mean, look, it all made that's Iron Maiden is that those core
classic,
guys.
Yeah.
That's Iron Maiden. That is Iron Maiden.
Yeah.
All these other, whatever they did after that, before that wasn't really Iron Maiden. It was some offshoot of it.
It's amazing now, though, like here we are in 2018 and Maiden is the biggest they've ever been.
I know, right?
And the genius, of course, when Bruce came back was, of course, bringing Adrian back as well. And talking to Bruce, he said that Steve always wanted a 3-guitar lineup because he loved Wishbone Ash and all that sort of stuff. And, they are maybe even double what they were in 1984 when Power Slave came out, or 1988 or whatever you're talking about. But, yeah, man. So, I mean, if you have to pick, this is the final Number of the Beast versus Power Slave. I think I know what you're going to say.
Well, yeah, I'm going to say Number of the Beast for sure. So that's my all-time favorite record. But Power Slave is easily in my top 10 records of all time.
Would it be
it would be my second favorite record.
And a lot of people don't say that. Like, you get to the Eddie Trunk crowd, like the Portnoys and those guys, they'll go Peace of Mind.
I actually, my Maiden records go Number of the Beast 1, Power Slave 2, Killers 3, and then Peace of Mind 4, with really Seventh Son or Seventh Son really close to that as well. I mean, it's
my
it's
my there. Second
and Somewhere in Time is great too.
Power Slave for me with Seventh Son is my second favorite.
Yeah, I love Seventh Son. Yeah. People kind of don't give that record enough credit, but I love that record.
They just played that song on the way here.
Oh,
the
yeah?
song, Seven
yeah.
Son? Oh,
nice. With Bruce doing the narration.
Yeah.
It's hysterical.
But once again, like, you know, I think Power Slave to me, because I bought it with this, I think I bought it the same day that I bought a ticket for the concert, which was only maybe my second concert or third at most.
Yeah, it was my third.
And just, yeah, and the whole buildup of like, I can't believe I'm going to get to listen to this album, I get to see this band. And then Seven Son came out just as we were about to graduate from high school. I think it came out like in March, the last 3 months of my high school life, which all of us, I'm sure you think of it as in a good, unless you had a really shitty high school, but it's one of the highlights of your life is that high school experience. And Seven Son was the soundtrack for it. Yeah. So that was my number one too. And I will say this before I go over to Liz. I bought Number of the Beast on album, finally, a couple, probably a year after Power Slave. I went back, bought all the rest. And I bought it from a comic book shop, a used comic book shop. And I also bought a Playboy magazine, or maybe it was a Penthouse, and I slid the Playboy magazine into the album to sneak it into my house, because my mom always asked me what I bought. So I couldn't just have a Playboy magazine, so I slid it into the album. So she goes, "What did you buy?" I bought this Iron Maiden album. Number three. She goes, "Well, let me see it." I'm like, "Why? Just let me see it." So she took the album. It's like one of those movies where like the dead body's right underneath. It's like, just don't look. And she was looking at it. She turns it over. I'm like, if she like holds it, it's gonna fall right out. It's a big Playboy magazine. Oh. And she never found it, but she did give me shit when Number of the Beast came on. You can't listen to that, it's satanic. And I said, yes, and I'm gonna go play Dungeons and Dragons tonight too. Jeff, your favorite out of the two?
Power Slave.
Yeah, well, there you go. The shirt and everything. Yep. Same. Well, what reason, why?
Well, like again, that was my experience, my opening to, you know, really listening to him. And that was my third concert. Like the year I was able, my parents would let me ride the bus and go to a concert by myself, you know, after Judas Priest. And that.
What was your first one?
The Judas Priest, Great White.
Oh, Defenders of the Faith. So that was before. Okay, I was
that
one
was
too.
In like June.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, I had to cut grass, but $13 ticket. All I could get was, I couldn't even afford a shirt. So I bought a headband, you know, the silk headband.
Headband?
Yeah. That's all I had to buy.
Was there Lizzie Borden headbands?
We had them, yeah.
Every 80s band did.
And then we talked off air about the other concert that was it that Whitesnake and Crocus? Or no, it was the Crocus.
Crocus Quiet Wasp Riot. And Helix. Yeah. Yeah. Or Kick-Axe, Whitesnake, Quiet Riot.
Yeah. So that was in like November. And then Iron Maiden was like the beginning of December with Twisted Sister. And they're both great albums. And Twisted Sister was, you know,
is this like a momentous occasion in Jericho podcasting where Jeff's not only awake at the end, but he's actually coherent too?
Well, we only had a small little half full thing of little vodka.
I think so. We've done this podcast way too early in the day or something's going on here.
Well, you know, he's a much better guest before 6 o'clock.
You know, what's interesting about you two guys picking Power Slave over Number of the Beast is it really does depend on when you come in on a band, what your favorite stuff is. Like I have friends who, you know, fans, and I mean, I came in obviously in the early days, and you know, all my favorites of the earlier stuff. But I have a lot of friends who came in later, like in the post makeup days. So you being one of them. Where you know, a lot of their favorite stuff is that time period, which is good stuff. But you'd never like, wow, really over the iconic stuff. But it really is when you come in.
And
you can say the same thing with so many other bands. Like when you come in is where you kind of get involved, and you go backwards.
Yeah, and that's why I don't have any problem like standing up for. Non-makeup Kiss, because that's what I came in on.
Sure.
And I love makeup Kiss.
And it's not bad stuff either.
Yeah, and that's why Paul Stanley was always my guy, because Paul was the boss in those time frames. But my first Kiss experience, besides guys that listened to it, you know, that I knew, was Heaven's on Fire. The video where he jumps through the hoop at the beginning or the end, whatever it was. His hands are on fire at the beginning, he jumps through. I'm like, that guy is the coolest guy on the planet, which I'm sure you might have said, Lizzie, when you saw the Star Child in 1978.
I did.
There you go. So cool is cool, no matter what era it is. And that's why, like we said, Power Slave for me, Number for you, Killers for somebody else. Paul said it best. It doesn't matter what floor you get on the elevator. You still get to the top.
You get on there,
that's
yeah,
right. And if you get off good. On a floor before the top, thanks for joining us for whatever it was, you know.
And Lizzie has to break the is it going to be a tie for which is the best album here?
I'm afraid it is.
Yes. That's what I want to hear.
Just because
that's the right answer.
All my favorite bands are 70s bands, and they had the rock influence, and even Priest was making it toward the metal, you know, they turned the gain up on their Marshalls little bit more for each album. But Maiden came full bore. They were a metal band. There wasn't any rock.
They were not ashamed to say we're a heavy metal band.
Yeah.
The British metal onslaught.
And at that moment in time, that's what built the whole Hollywood scene. Everyone wearing leather jackets and jeans and white tennis shoes and following that metal thing. And then, you know, that opened the door for everybody.
And you can't have a discussion about Iron Maiden without going back to the new wave of British heavy metal, which was the scene that started all, you know, Def Leppard and Iron Maiden and Saxon and, you know, on and on, which was a huge iconic moment just for me. I mean, that's really what changed my, you know, I was into metal. Like, I was into all the 70s, you know, bands, Priest and, you know, UFO and all that stuff. And I loved Kiss, but I also liked Elton John. I was a big fan of punk rock stuff. I was really big into like the new wave thing, like Oingo Boingo and the Go-Go's and all these bands playing around LA. And it wasn't really until the new wave British heavy metal came in that it was like, all right, forget all this other stuff. It's only metal now for me. And that, you know, that was a massive scene because when it came out in the late 70s, that was the whole disco time when, you know, Kiss and even Priest were doing disco records, or, you know, the Stones, all those disco influences. Everybody thought, that's it. You know, hard rock's over. It's all over. It's being replaced by disco. And then you have new wave coming in and the punk rock scene. And then just out of nowhere in England in 1979, this just underground, a completely underground scene of do-it-yourself. Just, there were no labels. It was all just kids doing it, bands doing it. And that really had a massive influence on me and also Metallica and Slayer and everybody else. So that scene was so iconic. And it's amazing that that had so many massive bands coming from it. And Maiden came out of that scene, obviously became this, you know, massive band, but they were part of that whole big scene with all of those bands.
It's interesting hearing you say that as we wind down here. You're wearing a Saxon shirt, which is one of the cornerstones of the new wave of British heavy metal. It never made it to the heights of Leppard or Maiden, but I would say number three of all time biggest new wave of British heavy metal bands. I mean, we could debate that. I'm not sure who you might say is number three.
Yeah, I think you're right.
But you're wearing the shirt, and it's not the same one, that changed heavy metal history. Had you not worn that shirt to the concert you went to, and Lars sees it and asks you.
No, that was the other way around. Okay. Lars
had
wore
Lars
the shirt.
Not worn the Saxon
and,
shirt.
And it wasn't even me that saw it. It was my friend John Carnarens. We were the only two in LA that knew anything about it. He saw Lars in the parking lot of the Michael Schenker Group show in 1980 and with that Saxon European t-shirt on and said, "Where'd you get, you know who Saxon is?" He's like, "Of course I do." And
but like I was saying, like, you know, everything happens in the way it's supposed to. Had you not met him that night because he was wearing a Saxon shirt, your friend John saw it.
Yep.
You never know.
I know, right?
You might not be who you are. He might not have ever had a place to put out his first song, which became something, something. I mean, Metallica was going to happen either way, but might not have happened the same way had you not seen the Saxon shirt
in
the parking lot.
Who really knows? You know, Lars makes, you know, he very kindly wrote the foreword to my book, and he made this statement in the book, because at the time that first Metal Massacre happened, you know, those guys weren't even talking. Like, they had rehearsed a couple times, but nothing happened. So there's nothing going on between them. And it was really the fact that they had a chance to be on a record is why he called up James. We had been on a record, and they started going back again. So Lars made the point, like, I mean, look, my role is tiny, and I agree with you. Something probably would have happened at some point, but it's really crazy how things just happen in
based
this weird,
around a t-shirt.
Exactly, right, or a scene, I mean? or music. It's
yeah,
it's amazing.
Last question, because you said your first concert was the Priest one.
Yep.
First concert, Brian?
First concert, Kiss, 1976.
Which would be Destroyer?
It was on the Alive tour before Destroyer.
Oh,
they did
wow.
a tour on Alive before Destroyer came out.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Yep. Liz?
Same exact thing. I was probably on the other side in Loge.
I know
exactly where I sat.
It was at this forum?
It was the forum. And I went, oh my God, what is this? This just,
what is this?
It was over the top. Yeah. From then on, I was like, that's it. My vision was narrowed to exactly what I wanted to do.
The first concert I ever went to was the Police Synchronicity Tour.
Nice.
And the first live band I ever saw was the Thompson Twins.
Nah. Oh wow. Okay.
I always they opened for the Police, and I was like, those guys are stupid. I remember them just bouncing, lies, lies, lies. Yeah. I'm like, get the fuck out of here.
See, first concert's always pretty easy because it's generally, for the most part, an epic thing. I'm always curious about people's second concerts. Mine was Boston at the Santa Monica Civic with Yesterday and Today, who became Y&T opening.
Wow, were they billed as Yesterday and Today?
Yeah,
wow.
And their first record hadn't even come out yet, and they blew Boston off the stage. I was like, wow, who is this man?
Interesting.
I gotta go buy.
Do you remember your guys' second concert?
You know, I could be fuzzy about the timeline, but I and it might be wrong, but I think it was UFO in Rush at the Santa Monica Civic.
No, that was... Oh, well, you might be right, because I wanted to go to that show, and I couldn't. So I think that might have been before the Kiss one.
No, because Kiss was the first show I ever saw.
Oh, well, yeah, it was. I hate you for going to that show. By the way, I remember looking at that show going, I want to go to that show, and my mom wouldn't let me. Damn it.
Russ was wearing Kiss capes.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah.
The kimonos.
what yours was? That was that Quiet Riot triple bill.
Quiet Riot got booed off the stage.
Yep.
It's funny, Dean Mullen, this guy that we know in Winnipeg, went back and looked up all the concert reviews from the paper. He found some website. And Winnipeg journalists hated Quiet Riot because they buried them for years after that show.
Yep.
Not like the horrible Quiet Riot show in 1984. I was like, dude, it's 1988. Give them a break. They're done. They're finished. My second concert was the Scorpions, Love at First Sting tour. Opening band, hated them. I just couldn't wait for him to get off stage. He had all these scarves on his microphone. He was this sickeningly good-looking guy, and I went, this band sucks. They got a stupid name. They'll never make it.
Yeah, I know
you know what they were called? Bon Jovi.
I saw that.
I saw them on the Bon Jovi opened. That's when they blew up on the...
They opened on the Priest on the out in the cold tour or whatever it was.
Yeah,
they
had the Runaway.
Yeah, that was their big song. I kind of like that one, but
I actually liked Bon Jovi when I first saw them. I think it was a Scorpion show. I wasn't really familiar with them, but I thought
I hated that them. Bad. I hated the name.
I could see why
Bon Jovi.
Like, yeah, I could
see
why.
What a stupid name. But then I'm in a band called Fozzy, so what does it matter? Guys, what a great time! Thank you so much, and up the Irons.
Yes.
All right. Thanks again to Lizzie Borden. Pick up his new record, My Midnight Things. I love it. Classic Lizzie Borden. You get that wherever you buy music. Thanks to Brian Slagle from Metal Blade Records. Go buy anything on Metal Blade. There's a million great bands that he's discovered and signed. And also Red Solo Cup Jeff. If you're ever in Vegas, you'll see him walking around with no shirt and a Red Solo Cup. I'm glad he stayed awake and he contributed the most words he ever has on an episode of Talk is Jericho. Now we just got to work on his mic technique. You can actually hear what he has to say. We'll get it right one of these days, Jeff. All right, did you book your cabin for the upcoming Chris Jericho's Rock and Wrestling Rager at Sea Part 2? Setting sail January 20th, 2020. We're already 75% sold out in just over a month. It's crazy. So book a cabin while you still can at ChrisJerichoCruise.com. We just added more amazing talent to the already stacked lineup. Booker T is going to be there. Queen Charmel, Shaul Guerrero, Jared James Nichols, one of the greatest guitar players in the world today. Dave Spivak Project returns. We love the DSP. He did great last year. We got the NWO, Scott Hall, Kevin Nash, and X-Pac. The host is comedian Brad Williams. Vicky Guerrero is our special cruise director. Fozzy's playing. Farewell to Fear is playing. Rubik's Cube, the greatest 80s cover band you've ever heard. AEW will also be there, the hottest new wrestling promotion in the world today. DDP will host more DDP yoga workshops on the ship. Jake the Snake will be there. Beyond the Darkness, hosting more creepy paranormal events. The talent list just gets longer and longer and longer. So come enjoy the best vacation of your life. Still got some big names to announce coming up. Book now at ChrisJerichoCruise.com. Don't forget, Fozzy opening for Iron Maiden September 14th at the Bank of California Stadium in Los Angeles. Four shows coming up May 14th, 15th. No, is it 15th? What we got coming up? Let's go look at the schedule as we see what we have. May 15th in Greenville, South Carolina. May 16th in Greensboro, North Carolina. May 17th, Virginia Beach, Virginia. May 18th, Camden, New Jersey at the MMR Barbecue. That's close to Philly. We're having a great time out there. We want you to come join us. Come rock with us, and we'll see you Wednesday. My old travel partner from WCW, ring announcer Dave Penzer, will be here. Some great stories about being on the road back in the 90s with him. Until then, have a great weekend. Stay hard, stay hungry. Peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy.
The Westwood One Podcast Network.